WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Tracy Johnston expected to face difficulties when she went down Borneo's most treacherous river. She endured floods, foot rot, sweat-eating bees, and leeches, but she wasn't expecting the onset of menopause. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Johnston about what happens when an adventurer meets up with the truly unexpected. Also, we call Zagreb, Croatia, to talk with Jette Sorensen, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, about the difficulties the Red Cross is facing in the former Yugoslavia. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Matinee, directed by Joe Dante and starring John Goodman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton took steps today toward lifting the ban on homosexuals in the military, but he tempered the action with a compromise designed to reconcile critics in Congress and the military. The president directed that a formal order reversing the ban be prepared by July 15th. In the meantime, he said that new recruits to the military will no longer be asked about sexual orientation. He said the plan was not everything he originally hoped for, but he called it a dramatic step forward.
The issue is not whether there should be homosexuals in the military. Everyone concedes that there are. The issue is whether men and women who can and have served with real distinction should be excluded from military service solely on the basis of their status.
Senator Sam Nunn said that his Armed Services Committee will hold extensive hearings on the effects of changing the military policy. Though Nunn supports keeping the ban, he said he respects the president's views and his work with Congress on the issue.
Persistent media reports that I am somehow irritated over not being consulted on this issue by the administration are totally false. I'm confident that President Clinton understands my own personal views on this issue, and I'm also very confident that he understands the constitutional responsibilities of the Congress in raising armies and maintaining our military forces.
Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn. In Geneva, the Bosnian peace talks appear to have reached the closing crunch. Tomorrow, the international negotiators will ask the leaders of the three warring sides to give a final yes or no to their proposed peace package. Sylvia Poggioli reports from Geneva.
After 7 days of intense negotiations between the leaders of Bosnia's Muslims, Croats, and Serbs, there are still substantive differences over a proposed map dividing post-war Bosnia into 10 provinces. The conference spokesman said this evening that mediators Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen do not expect these problems to be resolved at the 11th hour. If one of the parties says no, Vance and Owen will draft a status report on the peace conference for UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali. The negotiators have warned that they will name the names of the party which has obstructed the peace talks. It will then be up to the Security Council to decide what measures to take to try to put an end to the Balkan conflict, which has already claimed tens of thousands of lives. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today, partly on the strength of a boost in factory orders for durable goods in December. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 4 points to close at 3,310. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy said today that federal meat inspection was not to blame for the illnesses and at least one death caused by tainted hamburger in the Northwest. The Agriculture Department oversees the meat inspection and safety program. Espy said it appeared that bacterial infections from hamburger served at Jack in the Box restaurants were caused by improper cooking of the hamburger patties. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell told members of the National Academy of Social Insurance today he believes a consensus is forming on the need for dramatic reform of the nation's health care system. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
Mitchell, a member of Hillary Rodham Clinton's task force on health care reform, says one of the group's main aims is to restore security to family budgets by removing the fear that a large medical problem will lead to bankruptcy. Mitchell says these fears affect the insured as well as the uninsured.
When companies can unilaterally reduce coverage as soon as a worker contracts a serious illness, when insurers can refuse to cover a pre-existing condition, the premise of shared risk is being abandoned. I believe that healthy people should not be the only ones who can get health insurance in America.
Mitchell says the reform should build upon the nation's existing employer-based system, with the federal government helping small employers who might be hurt by any new health benefit requirements. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
As many as 100,000 workers in the energy industries are threatening to strike next week if contract talks collapse. The president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, Robert Wages, has scheduled a news conference on Monday, hinting that he may announce a strike by about 40,000 refinery workers. In a separate dispute, 60,000 coal miners are threatening a strike when their major contract expires on Monday. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Talk about your basic midlife crisis. Tracy Johnston was on an expedition down the wildest river in Borneo when she had her first menopausal hot flashes. Johnston is a journalist who was invited by the Sobek Adventure Travel Company to participate in the first descent down Borneo's Bow River. The company hoped to open the river to commercial rafting. The river has an 18-mile section that funnels through a steep, narrow gorge. Local guides said the rapids in the gorge were unrunnable. No one had done it before. As the team was about to start the run, a woman from a Borneo village said a prayer for the misguided white people who were going to die in the gorge. Johnston's new book, Shooting the Bow, is about the adventure down the bow and about the less-than-thrilling discovery that she was the only person over 40 on the expedition. I asked her what she expected when she signed up.
I thought it was going to be a modest adventure. I knew it was an exploratory river trip and that the river had never been run before, which meant that there might be some surprises. On the other hand, I had read the catalog, the Sobek catalog, which described the trip as of average difficulty. So that kind of clung on to that description. You know, average, certainly I could handle.
Was it of average difficulty?
Well, let's just say, that Sobek is not offering the trip anymore. It was really, we were one emergency away from disaster, I'd say.
What is the river like, the Bow River in Borneo?
Well, the Borneo is right in the equator, and there's really primary tropical hardwood rainforest all around it. And the part that we were going through was a 20-mile section called the Bow River Gorge, and it was surrounded by steep rock walls on both sides. And the water there, I don't know why we didn't really know this, I guess because we didn't have time to scout it. The water was really almost one continuous journey of white water, frothing white water. It was very damp and humid and fetid in the gorge like it is in any rainforest. And also we found out what happens to rivers in a rainforest when it rains. There's no soil really on the ground, and so all of the water just pours right into the river off the gorge and off all the mountains. And in fact, there was one time when we were really in quite a desperate situation because the river was beginning to flood. It rose about 2 feet in 10 minutes, and we realized we'd have to find a place to get out, to get up to high ground, and that wasn't always possible on this river. Now, luckily, at that point, we did, and then the story of what happened to the river when it flooded is another amazing story, but the river really did become a kind of personality on the trip, as does the rainforest.
Now, you describe yourself as the oldest and the weakest person on this trip. What did it mean to be the oldest and the weakest?
Well, the oldest meant being over 40. The weakest meant, not sure I was the weakest, but I did have a bad back problem. In fact, for the first time in my life, my back had been thrown out and about 2 weeks before the trip. And so I knew that I had to, especially when we got in this dangerous situation in the gorge, I knew that I had to do anything to keep myself in good shape. The worst thing would have been to have somebody who, like, couldn't move, had a bad back.
We should mention the bursitis, too, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Oh, right. Yes, I've done a lot of traveling and slept on a lot of hard floors and a lot of rocks, but I've always had an air mattress because I do have this bursitis in my hips, and it just hurts to sleep on my side. And because of this back problem, I couldn't sleep on my back. So yes, I was, as you know, I was inordinately worried about an air mattress. You know, I'm sure now that I think of it, I could have made it without an air mattress. I did learn from this trip that you can withstand a lot of things that are not comfortable, more than you would imagine, actually.
Had I known you when you were setting out on this voyage, I would have told you it was really stupid to go with a bad back and bursitis.
Well, my husband told me it was stupid to go. But then he doesn't really quite understand the flirtation with real adventure that I have. Would you understand that? I mean, do you understand
why
somebody...
Try me. Go into it a little bit.
Well, I had been on one river trip before where I had been dumped in the water and realized that I was at the mercy of the river and had almost died. And, you know, my husband said to me, you know, 8 years ago you did that, and now you're telling me you have a good idea. You want to go on another river trip. But all I could tell him is in uncomfortable situations or dangerous situations, I find that I can almost transcend myself. You know, life gets very simple. And as, you know, as happened to us, if we happen to find a package of instant mashed potatoes at the bottom of a food bag and you eat it, and it tastes fabulous, and you realize, my God, you know, all I need is something great in my mouth, and I'm happy, you know, no matter how many bugs are biting me or how many bees are swirling around me. Or you take a bath one night in a warm river with a bar of soap and the moonlight on you, and you kind of are really feeling things and seeing things in a new way that you almost get transformed, and then... That brings me, I guess, to what happened on this trip, where it really did become quite an adventure. We knew we were in a dangerous situation. We knew we were in a part of the world where practically maybe 10 human beings had ever been in the history of mankind. And there's kind of an adrenaline rush that comes from that. And, I don't like terror, I guess, but I kept thinking of the poem Leda and the Swan, that, you know, there's some dark force and you're getting close to it. Whether it's death or whether it's the evil three-headed river spirit that the Dyaks believed were in the gorge, whether it's just adrenaline or not. But it's kind of the closest I can come to being really transported into a new life.
The kind of thing I wonder about, because you asked me if I understood this, you know, if I understood mm-hmm. this kind of desire for adventure. Well, what I wonder is when you're there and you're facing the terror and you're risking your life, do you ever ask yourself, well, what am I risking it for? I mean, it's this journey that I'm going to write a magazine article about. Okay, it turned into a book. But, I mean, do you know what I mean? You're not there to save lives. You're not there to, like, defend your country or even defend your family. You're there just for the sake of it, you know? And so when you're facing your own death just for an adventure that has no point beyond adventure, what do you tell yourself?
Well, I know what I tell myself. There was actually only one point in the trip where I thought I was going to die, and that was again when I had the boats had overturned, and I was really trapped at the bottom of a waterfall, and I was just held there, held in place, out of breath, gulping air, and I know exactly what I thought. It was exactly the same thing that you said. Oh, you know, God, I'm going to die because of this stupid river trip. But then the rest of the time, I didn't feel that I was going to die. I mean, there wasn't terror. We were trying to make our way out of the canyon. It was uncomfortable. But I was cautious. I was never in a situation in which I wasn't in control in terms of just walking, traversing the river and whatnot. But yes, I agree. I thought that very thing, you know. Oh, you know, this is really, really dumb.
So
you know, forget it, I guess, like childbirth or something. You just forget it.
So when you were saved from that near-death experience, was there something very exhilarating about realizing, wow, false alarm, I'm not going to die?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, what's that
yeah.
feeling like of being saved from death on this adventure?
Oh, well, it was amazing for me. I met up with Sylvie, the French woman who was in the boat with me, and she had had the same experience and was basically just kind of was mad and was worried and was complaining, and I just found that I had this big smile on my face. I just still felt exhilarated, I guess. It was like soldiers coming home or something. On the other hand, that swim, that initial swim, which happened the first day of the trip, did do something that I really didn't like for the entire rest of the trip, and that was that it made me scared. I was, for the first time, I was really scared of whitewater. I had thought, naively, I guess, that because we were making this trip with really world-class river guides, and they were handling the boats, and all I had to do was hang on and bail, I thought it would be like riding on the shoulders of a competition skier or something. I would get taken down this river in incredible style, but I would be safe. And what I realized is that if the boats flip and I'm in the water, no matter how good the guides are, it doesn't make any difference. You know, I was on my own.
Tracy, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about what it was like for you to go through the early stages of menopause while going down the Bow River in Borneo. Tracy Johnston is my guest. She's the author of Shooting the Bow, A Woman's Voyage Down the Wildest River in Borneo. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Johnston, author of the new book Shooting the Bow, about her voyage down the wildest river in Borneo. Tracy, in your book you have a little inventory of your physical condition, of all the bites and funguses and so on that plagued you at one point during your journey. Let me ask you to read that inventory for us.
Okay, yeah, this is basically what happens to you if you have to spend any amount of time at all in a rainforest. Before I went to sleep, I made a written inventory of my physical condition. Feet, covered with red spots, particularly under my left arch, dark red sores between my toes with stinging, broken skin, foot rot arrested, but not gone. Ankles, right ankle swollen for some reason, left ankle has an open sore on it, have to beg for some antiseptic. Legs, four dark bruises on my left leg and a huge welt behind the knee, a spider bite, two dark bruises and a bump and gash on my right shin, plus a line of poison something on my calf, oozing and itching like crazy. Arms. A new rash on my right arm. Hope it isn't the same poison thing. Two immense bites, one on each arm, still swollen, about 2 inches. Hands. A splinter festering in my thumb, 8 fingernails broken. Mouth. The sore on my gum, neither better nor worse. Mind. Mildewed, lethargic, maybe rotten. Heart, love you, John.
And John is your husband.
John's my husband, yeah.
Who was at home wondering why the heck you were on this voyage in the first place.
He was.
Okay,
thank God they didn't call him when we were a week late. I don't know what he would have done.
So here you are, your body's kind of falling apart. So is everybody else's on the trip. And to top it off, you start having the symptoms of menopause. You're going to sleep at night and having hot flashes.
Yeah, and, you know, this was before Gail Sheehy's book. This was before anybody was, like, mentioning the word menopause. In fact, I had never talked about it with any of my friends. I knew that I was beginning to go through the early stages of it, but I hadn't experienced hot flashes before. And in the middle of the Bow River Gorge, where it was unbelievably hot, we were right on the equator, I started having hot flashes. At first, I didn't know what they were. All I knew that I would get incredibly hot and all the sweat-eating bees would start buzzing around me and landing on me. And when I finally realized what it was, I was embarrassed and I was almost ashamed. I certainly didn't tell anybody on the trip about it. They were all much younger. I don't think they would have been interested. I really decided to write about my personal journey, as well as the physical one on the Bow, only when I came home. And I thought at the time, you know, that this is ridiculous to be so ashamed of this because it happens to every single woman. So I tried to examine not only the hot flashes that happened to me, but the whole kind of confrontation with middle age I had on this trip. In many ways, it was a crisis of self-confidence, and in some ways that was even worse than the physical journeys for me.
Were you embarrassed to tell other people about it because it meant you were getting older? Or because it was just so personal?
I guess because it was personal and nobody, I'd never talked with it about anybody about it. I never talked to anybody about it myself, not even my mother. I thought it was something people didn't talk about, which they didn't really. And also, I didn't want them to know how old I was.
Why not?
I do know that ageism exists. I felt it in various jobs and also. And I didn't want the guides to have to worry about me. They were kind of close to exhaustion, and they were really, you know, doing enough, and we were all trying to help them as much as we could. We also weren't a very close-knit group. You know, a lot of people think, oh, my God, you must have bonded with these people. They must be your best friends now. And the fact is that that really wasn't true. We felt that somehow talking about our old lives, about, you know, the magazine I used to edit, or the kind of a lawyer that John was, or Sylvie's fashion design styling, just seemed kind of silly. It seemed kind of jarring in the midst of this pure kind of rainforest and this pure adventure. And so we spent a lot of time just being silent together, and when things began to get a little serious, we all sort of turned inward. So it wasn't the kind of thing where I felt, you know, naturally that I would confide in someone.
How old were you during the trip?
I was 45 or 46. I can't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite say in the book, but now you all know.
Right. I think you said over 40.
Yeah, right.
Ambiguous.
Yeah.
So did you recognize what the hot flashes were when they happened, or did you just think, whoa, what a hot night?
Yeah, that's what I thought at first. Like, why are these bees? What's happening? You know, why are these bees pestering me? Yeah, and I would wake up, and they really were something. I would wake up in this little, finally, after about a 6 day in the river, we found enough room to actually set up tents. And having a hot flash in a tent in the tropics when it's raining and musty and your flashlight doesn't work anymore, so you can't really wander around outside. And if you went and sat down outside to try to get some cool air, there'd be leeches that would come after you. That was not a pleasant experience, just kind of lying there fanning myself. But, yeah, I finally figured out what they were. I mean, I said, these seem to be hot flashes to myself, and then I got it. Oh, yeah, hot flash.
Now, you also started to obsess almost about losing your looks, about, you know, getting older, not looking good anymore. And it struck me, I both understood it, and it also struck me as a kind of strange place to be worrying about your looks, considering everybody had, like, feet and arms and noses and mouths that were swollen like crazy because of fungal infections and insect bites. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody looked particularly good on the trip, or maybe that anybody even cared how other people looked.
Ah, but there was Sylvie.
Yes.
Remember, there was Sylvie on the trip, and before Sylvie, there was Olatz. There were two extremely gorgeous women on the trip.
And she's from the fashion industry.
That's right. Well, they both had been models. One was a full-time international class model, and she had the good sense to leave just before we got on the river. But Sylvie stayed, and Sylvie was a fashion stylist, and, you know, it was interesting. I thought of her after a while as kind of like a beautiful bird or animal, and I watched her a lot of the time, and then she began to have an affair with the gorgeous guide on the trip, and it was all very French in that it was very open, and she would kind of nuzzle him, and their long, beautiful limbs would entwine as they sat by the fire. So there was a lot of time to think about beauty and about what it gets you. And there's also, on this trip, I realized that on adventures in my life, I had usually counted on some man or another to want to help me, you know. And on this trip, they didn't really. I was alone. I was out, didn't have a buddy. And the guides really, I must say, were pretty exhausted. But, you know, I remember there was one time when I had gone into the woods to take for a bathroom stop, and when I came back, all the rope was gone for people to set up shelters because it was beginning to rain. And I went to a guide and told him about it, and I realized that in the past, I would usually count on somebody saying, well, you know, you can come sleep beside me or I'll help you. And Dave, this time, he said, well, just get a tarp and just sleep under it, just let it lie over your face, you know. And I said, what? And I realized that I was on my own on this trip. I had to go find rope and build a shelter, that Mike was helping Sylvie, but that I did not have, just from just from having youth, really, and not overwhelming beauty, but just having, just being kind of young and pretty, that I had gotten a lot. And, you know, I hadn't been able to admit that, or I hadn't really thought about that, that it had gotten me something that I wasn't going to get anymore, gotten attention. I had certain perks from it. And perhaps because we had a lot of time to think, and because I wasn't looking in the mirror, and because there wasn't any mirror along, but I just had a lot of time to think about that, and I realized that it's something I hadn't thought about before, and it was kind of scary, actually. What was I going to do? Was I going to be wittier? Was I going to be smarter? What was I, you know, or were I just going to get less attention in general from people in life?
Do you still feel that now that you're, you know, you're out of the bow, you're out of, you know, shooting the dangerous rapids and so on?
Well, yeah, I do. In fact, I had, it was really interesting. I had to, another thing I thought about there was, okay, if I'm not going to do these physical adventures anymore because I realize I'm getting too old to do them and I can't really rely on help, what am I going to do for adventure? And luckily, the magazine article that I was going to write became, turned into a book, because that became my second adventure. And that doesn't require any men to help me, you know. I did it all on my own, as I ultimately did the bow on my own, too. But I thought a lot about, you know, the second half of your life, and what are those adventures, what are those challenges going to be? And in a way, it's more frightening. They're going to be emotional challenges, intellectual challenges, spiritual challenges. They're all, you know, kind of, I'm all a little terrified of them, but also anxious to begin and try and take them on. And I've also found that that there is one wonderful thing about older people. I went on another river trip just as kind of R&R after this one on the bow, and Sobek said they'd send me for free in this lovely placid river trip. And I went there, it was in Sumatra, and there were some older people on the trip. And, you know, the conversation was so good. The conversation was so much better than it was on the bow. And the people had lots of life experience, they had wisdom, they were smarter, and I realized that there are wonderful things to growing old and sharing things with people your own age.
So I'm just curious if you feel that if you now, you know, at home and at work and in journalism, or writing your book, whatever, if you still feel like you're losing your looks and that's changing your life.
Well, no, I feel like in no way is it changing my life. My life is centered around my husband and my work, and it doesn't affect that at all. Thank God, I guess my husband still thinks I'm sexy. It really just changes the way strangers look at you, or whether or not they pay attention to you. That really is all it affects, and I don't miss it now that I don't need someone to pay attention to me because of nothing, you know. Basically, people paying attention to you because you're young and you're kind of pretty is paying attention, you know, just for something they were born with. And I am older now, and I do have other qualities that I hope will make people pay attention to me. But I miss the kind of easy way that it used to happen, you know, automatically. Yeah, but not very much.
Tracy Johnston, her new book is Shooting the Bow. She's a journalist based in Oakland, California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the International Committee of the Red Cross in the former Yugoslavia. We call Zagreb, Croatia, to talk with Jette Sorensen, spokesperson for the ICRC. It's been very difficult for the Red Cross to get around in this war because the warring parties have so little respect for the Red Cross emblem. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Matinee, the new movie starring John Goodman as an auteur of schlock horror films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. President Clinton moved forward today to lift a ban on homosexuals in the military. He directed that military recruiters immediately stop asking recruits about their sexual orientation. And he directed his Secretary of Defense to draft an executive order to completely eliminate the ban by July 15th. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Anxious to get the divisive controversy behind him and to avoid a potential defeat in Congress, the president compromised. Although President Clinton's directive no longer prevents gays from entering the military will still be able to take action against gay servicemen and women who do nothing more than say they are gay. These prosecutions, for status alone, will be allowed to continue, but final discharges will be suspended. Personnel who receive discharge orders will be removed from active duty and placed on standby reserve. This was the language insisted upon by the president's chief adversary on Capitol Hill, the powerful chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn. But Republicans in the Senate say they still intend to go ahead and press for a vote on the issue as early as next week. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
South African President F.W. de Klerk said today that he wants a multiracial government in place by June. However, in a nationally televised speech, de Klerk also gave a warning, saying that the simple truth is that a devastating war will ensue if negotiation does not succeed. The speech opened the 1993 session of the nation's parliament. This parliament is expected to be the last to exclude the 30 million black majority. But a similar prediction last year was followed by the collapse of negotiations between blacks and whites. The United Nations says that Iraq has agreed to disclose the names of foreign companies that helped to build up its military arsenal. A senior UN weapons inspector said that Baghdad has agreed to hand over a list of foreign firms which supplied parts and technology for its chemical, biological, and ballistic programs. The BBC's Fergus Nichols has more.
Even when last year United Nations inspections were going relatively smoothly, two crucial issues held up UN recognition that Baghdad was complying with the post-Gulf War settlement. Such recognition is necessary if UN sanctions on Iraq are to be lifted. The first obstacle was Iraq's refusal to accept long-term monitoring of its arms potential. On this, there appears to have been no progress. But on the second issue, providing details of which countries or companies supplied parts and technology to the Iraqi arms programs, there's finally some movement. Not just in the nuclear field, but now biological, chemical, and ballistic weapons as well. Mr. Smidovich, though, speaking at the UN's base in Bahrain after returning from Baghdad, struck a note of caution, saying Iraq's change of attitude didn't mean all the required information would be provided.
The BBC's Fergus Nichols. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining nearly 4 points. This is NPR News. As many as 100,000 workers in the oil and coal industries could walk off their jobs next week if negotiations now underway fail to produce new contracts. If they occur, walkouts by the 60,000 members of the United Mine Workers Union and the 40,000 members of the Oil, Coal, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union could present President Clinton with his first major labor problem only weeks into his administration. If a strike does occur and it lasts for some time, the supplies of coal and refined petroleum for consumers and industrial customers could be disrupted. The unions have not announced their strike strategy. If they do walk out, they could call a complete strike, or they could target specific companies for a walkout. Talks with coal workers have been held for the past 3 months with no indication of a settlement being near. The United Nations says that strong evidence exists to support claims that rape was committed on a large scale in the former Yugoslavia. From the UN, Linda Fasulo has more.
A UN team of medical and human rights experts spent nearly 2 weeks investigating allegations of widespread rape. The team found that all three sides, Serb, Croat, and Muslim, committed the crime, although the majority of documented rapes was committed against Muslim women. The experts found solid evidence that women were detained for extended periods and raped repeatedly, but the team could not put a figure on the wide-ranging estimates of total rape victims. The UN also says rape was used as an instrument of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia and Croatia. To reach its conclusions, the team examined medical records and statistical data and gathered testimony from victims and witnesses. A full report is expected next month. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
A congressional report released today criticizes NASA for underestimating the cost of its programs by billions of dollars. The General Accounting Office says the low estimates are caused by expensive, complex space equipment, as well as lengthy project balloon budgets. The GAO report says original estimates for 25 of the 29 programs it studied were too low. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. The International Committee of the Red Cross is used to operating in war zones, but last May it pulled out its workers from the former Yugoslavia because it had become so dangerous and anarchic. One of their convoys in Sarajevo was attacked after it was assured safe passage. One worker was killed. Red Cross workers have since returned to many of the areas of fighting. Their primary mission is examining detention centers, evaluating whether they meet the requirements of the Geneva Conventions. They're also providing food, clothing, and medical care, and conveying messages from displaced persons to their families. Earlier today, we called Jette Sorensen, an ICRC spokesperson based in Zagreb, Croatia. The fighting has recently spread to southern Croatia, but Zagreb is in the north. Since July, the ICRC has made several public statements regarding grave human rights violations. I asked her if this type of statement was unusual for the Red Cross, which is politically neutral.
We have spoken up publicly before when there have been very, very serious breaches of international humanitarian law. In this conflict and in this context, we have spoken through the voice of our president even more openly because the violations of the Red Cross are so grave and so serious here. There's absolutely no respect for the Red Cross emblem. And we saw that a little less than 1 year ago when one of our delegates were deliberately killed. Even if the convoy had been cleared with all departures, the convoy was attacked and the delegate died. And this is why, not only to protect our own lives, I mean, our delegates work in war zones and we know the risk that we take, but at least the respect for the emblem.
Why do you think there has been so little respect for the Red Cross and its emblem in the Balkans?
Well, in this part of the world, the Red Cross has not always been as independent and neutral as one could have hoped, which means that for many people, the Red Cross is linked to any authority that are in place. And we come in with our Red Cross, which is the same symbol because we belong to the same movement, and nobody understands that we come in and that we are neutral. The other problem, especially in the beginning of the conflict and even now, that everybody and anybody puts on a Red Cross, even other humanitarian organizations, smaller ONGs and so on, they put the Red Cross on because they think that it protects them. And you have also amongst the partners, they put Red Crosses on their cars when transporting arms or soldiers. And then we come with our cars with no other protection than the Red Cross. And, of course, nobody understands, so we become also a target.
From what you were saying, do I understand correctly that in the past the government has used the Red Cross as a symbol to hide behind?
No, not in that sense, not at all. But, I mean, in many of the national societies in the former Eastern Europe were part of the government. Very often you had the Minister of Health, who was also a president of the National Society. And that meant, of course, that the National Society did not operate as independently as it could. And in the eyes of the general public, the Red Cross, the National Society, was part of the authority. It is not a question that the hit behind it, but it's a question of this understanding that a Red Cross, whether international or national, must be completely independent and neutral.
The United States intelligence agencies have reported that the total number of prisoners on all sides now in the Balkans is about 70,000, which is much higher than the close to 3,000 prisoners that have been registered and visited by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Are you going to try to investigate this new high number?
Well, first of all, let's correct the number. We have had, since the conflict started, we have had access to nearly 12,000 prisoners. Around 4,000 have been liberated under our auspices. I mean, we have transported them from Bosnia outside. Others have been liberated. So we have seen more than 12,000 prisoners. The number of 70,000, we have got the lists, of course, and we are trying to find out to match those lists with our own lists. And we know that we have not seen all the prisoners, but we think that the figure might be too high. We cannot confirm it. We cannot do the country as long as we have not had access to all the places, but we do not think it is as high as 70,000. Already in cross-checking, many of those 70,000 are part of the 12,000 we have seen.
Joining us on the phone from Zagreb, Croatia, is Jette Sorensen, who's a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Jette Sorensen is with us from Zagreb, Croatia. She's a spokesperson for the International Red Cross. When the Red Cross investigates a detention camp, what does it look for? How does it go about investigating whether the camp is violating international law?
Well, when we visit the camp, of course, we see the prisoners. We talk with them, first of all, to know how they're treated. Do they have enough food? Do they have enough water? Do they have washing facilities? Are they able to go out, in fresh air? It's the same criteria all over the world where we visit. Do they need anything? Do they know where their family is? Do they want us to have this Red Cross message exchange with their families? We go around to see the facilities. How are the toilets? How are the cells? How are the places they are? Without entering now in this particular context, but in general what we do, after having visited, we do a report that is transmitted to the detaining authorities and the political authorities, and we take it to Geneva. We make recommendations what should be changed or what should be improved, and then we go back and check if the things are done, and then we go back again, and we go back again. We are not dealing with the release of a detainee or the why he is in a place. That is not up to us to judge because we are not a court. But we go back and we bring in whatever relief we can, or we bring with us doctors or medicines, or we ask for a transfer to a hospital and so on. In this particular context, as you know, we have been in the camps of Omaska, of Tjernopolje, or Manjača, where the conditions were very, very, very awful, and we have said that publicly, that those places were not meant for human beings, and that those people should be liberated, which we normally do not say, because we are not. It's not up to us to liberate. We visit them, and if the detaining authority decide to liberate detainees, of course, they go under our auspices to wherever they want to go. But in this particular context, in those camps around the Banja Luka area, the conditions were so awful. So we have talked out very, very clearly. We have negotiated with the parties, and they signed that agreement in October to release unconditionally all their prisoners.
What did the Red Cross see at these camps that was so extreme?
Well, there was not enough food. There was not enough water. They had no clothes. They could not wash. I mean, the maniata, it was horse stables. You can imagine 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people in horse stables, not meant for human beings. And we brought in, since we started visiting, lots of clothes and medicines. And when the camp was closed here in December, and many of the detainees that were brought with us to Karlovac in Croatia and handed over to UNHCR, as they said they would not physically have survived if we had not given food, clothes, and all that, because they were otherwise they would have frozen to death or starved.
Have you been on any of the visits to the detention camps?
No, not myself. Because, you know, visiting the prisoners, it's a Swiss delegate, as the ISIS is Swiss, and I'm not Swiss.
You have to be Swiss to visit the detention camps?
Yes, because the ICC is a private Swiss organization, and the delegates are Swiss. It's not a question of Swiss. It's mononational. But as the ICC was created and born in Switzerland, the Red Cross is born in Switzerland, and the ICC is the founding body of the whole Red Cross movement, so it has stayed Swiss, and the ICC as such is Swiss. I mean, the president is Swiss, the governing board are all Swiss, and the people visiting the detention centers are Swiss, because Switzerland is considered a neutral country, which means that the Swiss delegates can go all over the world without any problems, while many other countries you will have political conflicts because the country will not accept your nationality, not because not as a Red Cross, but because you have a nationality also, while the Swiss delegates are accepted all over the world without any problems.
You were talking before about how the political changes in Eastern Europe have affected the Red Cross, how the Red Cross used to be part of the government in the sense, you know, the Ministry of Health was involved with the Red Cross. Now that the communist governments have fallen and the governments have changed in Eastern Europe, has that made it any more difficult for the Red Cross to function there?
Yes, in many places it has been very difficult, because the former Red Cross societies have very often also been dissolved when the government was dissolved. Now new teams are being put into place, which means very often teams with not much experience in the Red Cross. So what we are trying to do now is sending delegates to the former Soviet Union, to all the republics, to Armenia, to Georgia, to explain what the Red Cross is about, to explain what is neutrality, what is independence, to explain how you set up a national society. And, of course, that is not something you can do overnight. It takes time, it takes staff, it takes means, it takes translations of all our publications and so on in the various languages to allow most people to understand, but we are doing that, and I mean, we cannot see a result overnight, but with a bit of patience, I think things will change. As political changes take time, and it takes time to change the mentality of the people.
The Red Cross has been fired on in Bosnia. It's been fired on in Somalia. Red Cross workers have been killed. Is this something new for the Red Cross? Is there on the whole less respect in different parts of the world for the Red Cross emblem and for Red Cross workers than there's been before?
I don't think we can say that generally. I mean, the people we have had killed, unfortunately, in Somalia, it has been an isolated criminal act by individuals. I mean, it was not particularly against the Red Cross. It was just somebody killing somebody, because it is also, as you know, an extremely violent war, and where there's no respect of nothing. But it was not against the Red Cross as such, as it was in Sarajevo, where we felt it was a direct attack against our convoy. We have had many security incidents. We have had many delegates and also local Red Cross people killed during the last years, but I think it is more because of the changing nature of the conflicts today that you have so many uncontrolled elements in most of the conflicts. You have small militia groups that obey to nothing except the law of arms, and they just kill. And I mean, if we are there, and as we are there in many cases, we are a target.
How is the Red Cross going to decide if and when it can send workers back into Sarajevo?
Well, we feel now that after, let's say, we have been absent for a long time. We have not been really absent because we have had local staff, ICRC staff, still being in Sarajevo and doing a lot of good tracing work. We have had delegates going in and out. We have not had a permanent mission. I mean, we have not had a permanent office and so on in Sarajevo. And let's say from our side now, we have decided to go back. We know that there is a risk, but there is a risk all over in this conflict, and there are people that that need our help. So I think the choice has been maybe long to come and difficult, but it has been taken that we have to go back to Sarajevo.
So do you know when you will officially send people
back
in?
No, not yet. I mean, there are still some logistical problems and so on, because it's very difficult to get into Sarajevo, because we have no airplanes here. We depend on UNPROFOR, UNHCR flights to get our stuff in and relief in and so on. But I think it will be in the next coming days or weeks.
Jette Sorensen is a spokesperson for the International Red Cross. She spoke to us from Zagreb, Croatia. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton held a press conference today on the ban on gays in the military. Robert Siegel, what do you have on that, on All Things Considered?
Well, Bill Clinton today announced a policy which I've actually seen one wire service describe as ending the ban on gays in the service, and another saying he decides not to lift the ban on gays in the service. What he's done is he's asked Les Aspin to promulgate an order for July 15th that would end the ban on homosexuals in the service. In the meanwhile, the military will stop asking recruits about their sexual orientation, but between now and then there'll be hearings in which critics of the move, like Senator Sam Nunn, are expected to try to advance their case to oppose it. We'll hear lots about this today.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like Jonathan Demme, John Sayles, and many other prominent filmmakers, Joe Dante learned how to make movies by turning out B-pictures for producer-director Roger Corman. Out on his own, he made The Howling, and then hit it big with Gremlins in 1984. But his last few films, including Inner Space, Gremlins 2, and The Burbs, were box office disappointments. Will his new movie make him red hot again? Stephen Schiff had a look at Matinee.
Actually, I think Matinee is destined to die a terrible death at the box office, which is too bad, because it's a labor of love for Joe Dante, and the love shows in every frame. Dante's clearly a movie nut, and Matinee returns to the years that made him one, the late 50s and early 60s, when small-town movie houses often showed creature features about giant insects and nuclear mutations. That was the era of Dante's mentor, Roger Corman, and also of his idol, William Castle, a terrible director, but one of the most audacious and inventive B-movie showmen of all time. It was Castle who lured customers into his film Macabre by issuing insurance policies against death by fright. And it was Castle who had the nerve to wire movie theater seats to produce a mild electrical shock during key scenes in his most famous film, The Tingler. Castle also liked to appear in his own trailers, and so does Dante's version of him, Lawrence Woolsey, played by John Goodman with a foot-long cigar and buckets of con man cheer. Matinee takes place in Key West, Florida, during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when every kid in the neighborhood was worried about impending nuclear doom, but not so worried that he couldn't be distracted by this trailer for Woolsey's next big picture.
Yes, the atomic bomb is terrible. But more terrible still are the effects of atomic mutation. Hello, I'm Lawrence Woolsey. And I want to warn you about something that could happen. Something that does happen in my newest motion picture. Observe the ant. A miniature marvel of social cooperation and prodigious strength. But if a man and an ant were exposed to radiation simultaneously, the result would be terrible indeed. For the result would be Mant.
In 1967, Susan Sontag wrote perhaps her finest essay on the movies, The Imagination of Disaster, which was all about how the threat of nuclear war had given rise to a new kind of science fiction film. In Matinee, Dante and his screenwriter, Charlie Haas, forged the same connections with half the effort, and they make a dozen other intellectually respectable points without so much as raising a sweat. Their story centers on Lawrence Woolsey's personal appearance in Key West to promote his film, but it's also a sweet-natured high school picture about the kids who get turned on by the prospect of Mant coming to town, and about their worried parents, and about what it felt like to live in America during the age of innocence that preceded the Kennedy assassination. Dante's work has always been characterized by a great eye for detail. The right props, the right music, the right clothes, flawless special effects. And for anyone who was young in the early 60s, Matinee is an orgy of remembrance. Lenny Bruce records, Fallout shelters, Davy Crockett t-shirts, and, of course, the movies themselves. Dante shows us Mant almost in its entirety, and it's just about perfect, right down to its star, who also happens to be Woolsey's girlfriend, played with a beautiful snarl by Kathy Moriarty. Universal Pictures is dumping Matinee into theaters with a minimum of promotion, and so it'll probably die a sad death, but it shouldn't. I can't imagine any baby boomer, from Bill Clinton on down, seeing this movie without being tickled by its wit and insight, and without feeling a more profound twinge for all those years we spent coping with the terror that is only now beginning to seem just another crazy relic of our youth.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Raising Black Children, we talk with Alvin Poussant, author of a new book on the subject. He also teaches psychiatry at Harvard University and formerly was a consultant to The Cosby Show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.